Occasionally, black kids would come into the store and we would play. It took me years to learn about segregation and prejudice and the meaning of poverty, years to learn that most white people weren't like my grandfather and grandmother, whose views on race were among the few things she had in common with her husband. In fact, Mother told me that one of the worst whippings she ever got was when, at the age of 3 or 4, she called a black woman the N-word. To put it mildly, Mamaw's whipping her was an unusual reaction for a poor Southern white woman in the 1920s. After the year in New Orleans, Mother came home to Hope, eager to put her anesthesia training into practice, elated at being reunited with me, and back to her old, fun-loving self. She had dated several men in New Orleans and had a fine time, according to her memoir, Leading with My Heart, which I'm sure would have been a bestseller if she had lived to promote it. However, before, during, and after her sojourn in New Orleans, Mother was dating one man more than anyone else, the owner of the local Buick dealership, Roger Clinton. She was a beautiful, high-spirited widow. He was a handsome, hell-raising, twice-divorced man from Hot Springs, Arkansas's Sin City, which for several years had been home to the largest illegal gambling operation in the United States. Roger's brother Raymond owned the Buick dealership in Hot Springs, and Roger, the baby and bad boy of a family of five, had come to Hope to take advantage of the war activity around the Southwestern Proving Ground and perhaps to get out of his brother's shadow. Roger loved to drink and party with his two best buddies from Hot Springs, Van Hampton Lyle, who owned the Coca-Cola bottling plant across the street from Clinton Buick, and Gabe Crawford, who owned several drugstores in Hot Springs and one in Hope, later built Hot Springs' first shopping center, and was then married to Roger's gorgeous niece, Virginia, a woman I've always loved, who was the very first Miss Hot Springs. Their idea of a good time was to gamble, get drunk, and do crazy, reckless things in cars or airplanes or on motorcycles. It's a wonder they didn't all die young. Mother liked Roger because he was fun, paid attention to me, and was generous. He paid for her to come home to see me several times when she was in New Orleans, and he probably paid for the train trips Mama and I took to see Mother. Mother and Roger got married in Hot Springs in June 1950, shortly after her 27th birthday. Only Gabe and Virginia Crawford were there. Then Mother and I left her parents' home with my new stepfather, whom I soon began to call Daddy, to move into a little white wooden house on the south end of town, at 321 13th Street, at the corner of Walker Street. Not long afterward, I started calling myself Billy Clinton. A lot happened to me while I lived on 13th Street. I started school at Miss Marie Perkins School for Little Folks Kindergarten, which I loved until I broke my leg one day jumping rope. And it wasn't even a moving rope. The rope in the playground was tied at one end to a tree and at the other end to a swing set. The kids would line up on one side and take turns running and jumping over it. All the other kids cleared the rope. One of them was Mac McLarty, son of the local Ford dealer, later governor of Boy State, all-star quarterback, state legislator, successful businessman, and then my first White House chief of staff. Mac always cleared every hurdle. Luckily for me, he always waited for me to catch up. Me? I didn't clear the rope. I was a little chunky anyway and slow. So slow that I was once the only kid at an Easter egg hunt who didn't get a single egg. Not because I couldn't find them, but because I couldn't get to them fast enough. On the day I tried to jump rope, I wore cowboy boots to school. Like a fool, I didn't take the boots off to jump. My heel caught on the rope, I turned, fell, and heard my leg snap. I lay in agony on the ground for several minutes while Daddy raced over from the Buick place to get me. I had broken my leg above the knee, and because I was growing so fast, the doctor was reluctant to put me in a cast up to my hip. Instead, he made a hole through my ankle, pushed a stainless steel bar through it, attached it to a stainless steel horseshoe, and hung my leg up in the air over my hospital bed. I lay like that for 2 months, flat on my back, feeling both foolish and pleased to be out of school and receiving so many visitors. I took a long time getting over that leg break. After I got out of the hospital, my folks bought me a bicycle, but I never lost my fear of riding without the training wheels. As a result, I never stopped feeling that I was clumsy and without a normal sense of balance, until at the age of 22, I finally started riding a bike at Oxford. Even then I fell a few times, but I thought of it as building my pain threshold. I was grateful to Daddy for coming to rescue me when I broke my leg. He also came home from work a time or two to try to talk Mother out of spanking me when I did something wrong. At the beginning of their marriage, he really tried to be there for me. I remember once he even took me on a train to St. Louis to see the Cardinals, then our nearest Major League Baseball team. We stayed overnight and came home the next day. I loved it. Sadly, it was the only trip the two of us ever took together. Like the only time we ever went fishing together. The only time we ever went out in the woods to cut our own Christmas tree together. The only time our whole family took an out-of-state vacation together. There were so many things that meant a lot to me, but were never to occur again. Roger Clinton really loved me, and he loved Mother, but he couldn't ever quite break free of the shadows of self-doubt, the phony security of binge drinking and adolescent partying, and the isolation from and verbal abuse of Mother that kept him from becoming the man he might have been. One night, his drunken self-destructiveness came to a head in a fight with my mother I can't ever forget. Mother wanted us to go to the hospital to see my great-grandmother, who didn't have long to live. Daddy said she couldn't go. They were screaming at each other in their bedroom in the back of the house. For some reason, I walked out into the hall to the doorway of the bedroom. Just as I did, Daddy pulled a gun from behind his back and fired in Mother's direction. The bullet went into the wall between where she and I were standing. I was stunned and so scared. I had never heard a shot fired before, much less seen one. Mother grabbed me and ran across the street to the neighbors. The police were called. I can still see them leading Daddy away in handcuffs to jail, where he spent the night. I'm sure Daddy didn't mean to hurt her, and he would have died if the bullet had accidentally hit either one of us. But something more poisonous than alcohol drove him to that level of debasement. It would be a long time before I could understand such forces in others or in myself. When Daddy got out of jail, he had sobered up in more ways than one, and was so ashamed that nothing bad happened for some time. By the time I was in fourth grade, we had moved to Hot Springs, and Daddy decided to rent a big house from Uncle Raymond at 1011 Park Avenue in the east end of town. He led Mother to believe he'd made a good deal for it and had bought the house with his income and hers. But even with their two incomes, and with housing costs a considerably smaller part of the average family's expenses than now, I can't see how we could have afforded it. The house was up on a hill, had two stories, five bedrooms, and a fascinating little ballroom upstairs with a bar, on which stood a big rotating cage with two huge dice in it. Apparently the first owner had been in the gambling business. I spent many happy hours in that room, having parties or just playing with my friends. We lived in that house from the time I was 7 or 8 until I was 15. Not long after we moved to Park Avenue, in 1955, I think, my mother's parents moved to Hot Springs to a little apartment and a big old house on our street, a mile or so toward town from our place. The move was motivated primarily by health concerns. Papaw had chronic lung problems, and Mamaw had had a stroke. Papaw got a job at a liquor store, which I think Daddy owned a part of. He had a lot of free time, since even in Hot Springs, most people were too conventional to frequent liquor stores in broad daylight, so I often visited him there. He played a lot of solitaire and taught me how. I still play three different kinds, often when I'm thinking through a problem and need an outlet for nervous energy. Mamaw's stroke was a big one, and in the aftermath she was racked by hysterical screaming. Unforgivably, to calm her down, her doctor prescribed morphine, lots of it. It was when she got hooked that Mother brought her and Papaw to Hot Springs. Her behavior became even more irrational, and in desperation, Mother reluctantly committed her to the state's mental hospital about 30 miles away. I don't think there were any drug treatment facilities back then. Of course, I didn't know anything about her problem at the time. I just knew she was sick. Then Mother drove me over to the state hospital to see her. It was awful. It was bedlam. We went into a big open room cooled by electric fans encased in huge metal mesh to keep the patients from putting their hands into them. Dazed-looking people dressed in loose cotton dresses or pajamas walked around aimlessly, muttering to themselves or shouting into space. Still, Mamaw seemed normal and glad to see us, and we had a good talk. After a few months, she had settled down enough to come home, and she was never again on morphine. Her problem gave me my first exposure to the kind of mental health system that served most of America back then. When he became governor, Orville Faubus modernized our state hospital and put a lot more money into it, despite the damage he did in other areas. I was always grateful to him for that.